So I want to try to cover the rest of Diamond and Bees today. So we saw a few simple things. We saw that we have two electrons in this electronic ground state. And that there was an electronic excited state as well, with the same labels. And that we could induce cycling transitions so that the separation here is 637, two, one of those nanometers. And if we excited from the zero, we would return to the zero, we could cycle forever. And for the plus minus one states, we would mostly cycle, but with a one-third probability, we'd have an intersystem crossing to the singlet state. And that would always take us back to the zero state. And so we could easily initialize them. Just turn on the laser. This separation we saw was about 3 gigahertz. It's a dipole-allowed transition. Remember that we wrote out the way we ended up with the spin one was to have two electron spins. They're dipole coupled. And let me just say a word here that if I have the nitrogen in the vacancy, the dipolar axis that we're looking at is here. And so think about this as the z-axis. And that's given by the so-called zero field splitting. And so the 3 gigahertz is the zero field splitting. Which goes as SC squared. In addition, we could apply a magnetic field. And the magnetic field would lift the degeneracy of these two levels. And the effective gyromagnetic ratio for this system is about 2.8 megahertz per Gauss. So if we apply a few Gauss, we can separate those energy levels. And then, of course, we can decide whether we're trying to excite one or we're trying to excite two. Of course, we have here a trit. So we can say that we have a Q trit. Or by selecting either the plus one or minus one, we could have a qubit. You might look, that's in fact, the minus one and plus one levels form a qubit as well. So if you decide that you want to have your qubit sitting in here, that's perfectly okay, except that you're going to have to use this level for control, right? So you could keep your information there, but control it via using this level. So I won't tell you about that anymore about that. It's easy to figure out. Now notice that if I have a nitrogen, then there are four directions where you can have a vacancy. So if I have a crystal, of course, that there's, you know, the nitrogen has to fit within that crystal lattice. And so the Z in a particular defect, so there are four possible orientations. Of the z-axis. And of course, what I mean is possible orientations to the crystal that you've placed in there, right? You have a macroscopic crystal, you've placed it in your sample, and that defines a coordinate system. You can call it the laboratory coordinate system. And then you find a defect. And then you experimentally must determine which of these four orientations you have. And what you would like is that this magnetic field, for almost everything you do, you like that field to be along the z-axis, right? If it's along the z-axis, then of course it's going to commute with this zero field splitting. It'll nicely cause energy separation. It's a simple thing to look at, which again we're not going to do, of saying, hey, what would happen if I place that field along, let's say, the x-axis? And then, of course, when it's small, it would not be important. And when it's large, then the system would be re-quantized in that direction. And so you would have a system that moves from one preferred axis frame to another. Okay. Now, we also saw that we could excite with higher energies and if we did excite with higher energies, that the spin state was preserved, so that this would fall down quickly, fast, non-radiative. To the zero manifold, and then, of course, we would have the picture that we have here. And when we excite, we're exciting into effectively a continuum of states. And so you might think that, oh, these states up here, they'll know whether I came from the zero manifold or the plus minus one manifold. And so by doing this, if we had coherence here, we would lose coherence. That piece in itself doesn't cause us to lose coherence because we're not in a pure state up here. We're in a highly mixed system. But of course, the decay from here to here, that decay, remember, it has a lifetime of 15 nanoseconds. So that says that there's a random time we're going to spend there. And these frequency separations are not exactly the same as these. And so if I spend a random amount of time up here, then, of course, I'm going to lose coherence. Yeah, so eventually we do lose coherence that way. And the lifetime of the dark state is 300 nanoseconds. And again, this thing is non-radiative. So we don't get a photon out. And so by looking at the intensity, if we are in the zero state, then we'll have a more intense photon beam coming out than if we were in the one state. And so as long as we look for a short period of time, we can differentiate whether we're in the zero or one state. But of course, eventually we always end up back in the one state. All right, so we have readout. And so at least we get two pieces of DiVincenzo's requirements. Now, we also saw that we could take this whole thing and build it into a confocal setup so that we could have our defect here in a focal spot drawing this wrong. So if we have a confocal arrangement, then we have a tiny focal spot of about 1 micron cubed. It's embedded in our sample. We can move the sample. And we can grow the crystal in such a way, or we can buy a natural crystal that has very few defects, so that on average your 1 micron cubed has no defects. Very rarely it will have one defect, and it will be extremely difficult to find one with two defects. Now I should say, it's of course also very easy to have a sample that has lots and lots of defects, and if you shine a green laser pointer on it, it will brightly illuminate red. So if your goal is to have a red diamond, then yes, you can have lots and lots of defects. And of course, we can put them in intentionally after the fact by having a nitrogen beam. So we can take an ion beam of nitrogen and implant defects. And we can do that to whatever depth we like, pretty much, and whatever average concentration we'd like. Yeah?
So with regards to the number of defects within the 1 micron spot, are the intensity sort of quantized, or how do you differentiate? Is it continuous? Or how do you know it's 1.5?
Okay, so within, once you have a defect and you're looking at it confocally, so then the way to think about this is I have some spot size where the intensity of the light that we're shining is very bright. Now, of course, it's a focal spot, so there's low intensities out here, but this is very bright. And the light that you're collecting predominantly from here. So here you have your focal spot. Somewhere in there you may have a defect. And then what we do is we use this as effectively a source. I'm going to say, well, this is my photon source. And that's pretty easy to do, because remember that in our setup, this is a dichroic mirror, so that the 637 nanometer light goes this way, and 532 goes that way. So if I'm sitting here, I can say, oh, well, I only have a source of photons here. And then I'm going to take this detector away, and I'll replace that detector with a beam splitter and two detectors. And remember, we looked at this going into a coincidence counter. And we looked at the so-called Hanbury-Brown twist effect, which says if you have a photon, you have one photon. And so if I look at the coincidence versus delta t here, then if there's a single photon source, I will find the dip. Because then, remember what delta t is doing. Delta t is effectively aligning the timing of those two detectors so that if they clicked, then we would know that two photons had to have entered this. So we're adjusting the timing to find that. And if there's more than one emitter in there, then there will be no time for which we see that there's a dip. So if there's multiple emitters, we'll just have something that looks like that. And the quality of how good of a single photon we have is how close to this dip, how close this dip gets to zero. So we can test that and say, yes, I want to experimentally show that I have one center and no more. You had a question as well? Yeah?
Why are we so concerned with getting just one photon?
That's a good question. So, you know, when we have one photon, we can do more with it. So if I have, let's imagine that I have a collection of photons. And I'm going to connect those collection of photons to some other system. And I want that collection to look like a qubit. It's very hard to make a collection of photons, a collection of qubits, collection of spins, look like one qubit to an outside world if it's going to see just the bulk magnetization of that. And so I'm going to show you in a few minutes as we couple defects together, why we want one. Other questions? Okay. Good. Now, maybe I just changed my order and answer your question. Imagine that that I would like to build a quantum computer. So I'd like to take these defects and couple them to each other. And so there's a set of ways that we can imagine doing it. And the first way that's been accomplished, sort of, is to say, let me keep one center, and I'll give you one. And we'll each go to our own lab, and we'll put them into a cavity. And so here we have a little NB here. I have a little NB. And we're going to take those two and place them on a mirror, on a half-silvered mirror, just like we did up there. So we have two detectors here. And now I'm not going to use the Hanbury-Brown twist. It looks very much like it. But I'm going to use something called a Hondo-Mandel effect. And this is a purely quantum effect, but you can understand it directly from the NV experiments, from the neutron experiments. That here, we're going to imagine that this is a mirror that depends upon the state of the NV. And that's the same thing over there. And so I'll send in my photons into the system. The reason I have a cavity is, one, to increase the interaction strength, but also to direct the photons out in one direction. So I would like to collect two photons. And now I imagine that I've excited both of these. Let's start with them in, it doesn't actually matter. The experiment was accomplished by Michalukin at Harvard with Marco Lonker. And they actually started in the zero state, which is technically much better. But it's a little bit easier to think about it starting in the one state. So now that I've got these two photon sources, and this, we're going to call them A1 and A2. And we can set the path lengths here. So that we have the photons coming out will only go to one of those two detectors. So the Hondo-Mandel effect tells us that if we have everything set up right, and I have two identical photons coming into the system, we can arrange that they will bunch, meaning that they will go both one way or the other way. And so I arrange that all photons go here, except if one NV changes state. And then if they do, one photon will go to each place. If that, then we have a photon. And so now I prepare the system, I sit there, I excite it, and I look. And at some point, I'll have a photon that shows up here. And then we say, okay, stop everything. Now I know that one of those two switched, but I don't know which one. Life is good, we have entanglement. Do something with it quick. And so that's the way of entangling in as a post-selection process. Now, the efficiencies of doing this are abysmal. It takes weeks to see one event. And partially you can understand that as I describe it, it sounds like we're just looking for one photon. But what really happens is, of course, I need to have two events. I need to see that two photons went here, or that one went to each place. So that if I run this experiment, I get just one photon from here, and the photon that's emitted here goes off into some random direction, well, those events don't count. And those are by far the most common thing to happen. Yeah. It's a continual beam from the laser. It's a nice experiment to think of. Let's take some particular state to the laser. But one, we wouldn't have the efficiencies. And two, this experiment doesn't want one photon. What it wants is to have a probability that the photon's absorbed. So here is just a laser. So that piece of the experiment is a little bit easier. Yes?
Has the experiment been done to verify the entanglement?
I didn't hear you.
Has the experiment been done to verify the
entanglement? Yes. You can. And, you know, if you allow them to choose what parts of the data they want to analyze, then you can show... you can show a Bell violation.
You can always do that if you choose one part. Well,
they try to be biased in a proper way. Yes? Yes, those are the intensities. So what you want to think about, let me say it differently. Take A1 and A2 as modes, and that these are the combination of the modes that you're going to see at those detectors. Okay? So then you could say, if you like, that replace those with the phase shift in the neutron interferometry experiment. And remember that by adjusting the phase in the neutron interferometry experiment, we can dictate that the neutrons would go to one detector or the other. Now take exactly the same physics, put two neutrons in at the same time, and look at it, and you'll see this effect. I'll send you to look on the web. You'll find it everywhere. Yes?
Sorry, what exactly do you conclude if you do not get a photon coming out one arm? Is that it was absorbed or that there was no photon emitted?
You don't know. There was no photon emitted, or the it was emitted not into your interferometer. So there's lots of reasons why you don't see its effect and you have to throw away almost all of your data. The other thing that happens, of course, is if I look at the spectrum, so intensity versus frequency of the photon emitted, then I see something like this that says, here is the good photons. Is wavelength. These are all the photons that interacted with the diamond and found some creative way to give a little bit of their energy to the diamond. And of course, you don't want those. So what you end up having to do is to say, okay, I want only those photons that are emitted, into these modes. I want only that subset where I find two photons here, and I want only the subset where they were both emitted at this energy, the so-called zero phonon line. It says no phonons were involved in this process. And so you know, the good news is it's easy to detect one photon. You know, the better news is that in such an experiment, there are lots and lots of events. And the bad news is that almost none of them correspond to what you want. But if you're patient, there will be an event. Yeah. Okay. So that's one way of connecting. And clearly here, we need to have one center in order to have these statistics. If I have two centers in these diamonds, then everything is out the window. Yeah. I was answering your question, which asked, why do we need only one center?
One photon. The coincidence detector.
If I have, the only way I get one photon is to have one center, right? If I have one defect, it goes through the cycle, and it gives off every time we have a cycling transition, it gives us exactly one photon, and then, you know, 15 nanoseconds later, you have a chance that you get another photon. Okay. All right. Yes, please.
So you're saying you don't actually know what happens if you get a pick from the top detector, but what's the scenario you're hoping for, which will put the two stars in different states?
You get a click at coincidence in both. right? So mostly I'm going to say, oh, all of the photons will go to one of them. All the photons will go to this detector. And then sometime we'll get a click at both of these. And remember, you've set your coincidence, you've set delta T so that you know that you're looking at the right time.
No, I'm at the experiment at the bottom right now.
This one, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So here you still have to set delta T so that there is a coincidence, right? Because you need to say, oh, I have this event. And this event that you're looking for is one photon came to each detector. Yeah? So you have a little window to look in. Okay, we're going to continue because I have a few more things I want to tell you about. Now, that's not the way that the field imagines building a quantum computer. We imagine building a quantum computer by magnetically interacting them. So let's take a look at this system and first look at metrology. And then I'll show you how it connects to having a computer. And so I'm just drawing the lower energy levels. So here we have the zero field splitting. Here we have the Zeeman splitting. And of course, the Zeeman splitting here is going to be dependent upon, it's going to be proportional to the local field. And we'll keep our local field along the z-axis just to make our physics a little bit nicer. And so then I could say, well, let me take a Ramsey experiment. So pi over 2, and then we're going to measure the probability that we're in zero as a function of some time. And we saw that when we did this, we would get fringes, and that those fringes will tell us the fluctuation of this field and the decay of those fringes. So if I, you know, schematically drew the fringes here, they would decay. And let me draw that a little bit nicer. You know, they would decay like this, right? Where this is the probability of being in zero is 1, and here we are at 0 as a function of time. And there would be a decay, and that decay would be T2 star. And T2 star is a fairly short number in these systems. It depends a lot on what defect, but we're talking hundreds of microseconds. And we said up here that our sensitivity is 2.8 megahertz per Gauss. And so if I wanted to use just this as a detector of a field, it wouldn't be that good. That you know, we could detect some Gauss, you know, and birds and worms can detect Gauss, right? We don't need a quantum device. All we need is a bird. So we say, well, I don't like this T2 star stuff. And we know how to change that. We put a pi pulse in between. And so now we go to the Hahn echo. And we say, great, we get a real long T2, right? So now we go from T2 star to T2, or, you know, we get closer to T2, right? We're suppressing the really static stuff. So now we get out to, let's say, 10 or 20 milliseconds. But of course, we've killed our ability to see a magnetic field. And if we have an external magnetic field, then of course the evolution during this window will be exactly canceled out by that window, and we're dead. So instead, I give a pi pulse to the field. So let's take this as being in V1. And this is going to be my second in V. And let's imagine that I have a diamond, and here's an NV. We'll call that 1. Is that the way I want to do it? No, I'll call this 2. And I'm going to put another diamond on a diamond pillar. So this is my NV2. And I'm going to allow this to move. And I'll look at the separation of these two at their shortest distance. So let's take 50 nanometers. 50 nanometers is an easily achieved separation for two things that are moving relative to each other. In fact, that's very loose. But the diamonds will be inside the material. The NVs will be inside the material. They won't be on the surface. And so if we have this, then we can calculate the dipolar field. You know how to do that. You know, it's a magnetic moment squared divided by the distance cubed. And it turns out to be 10 nanotesla. So that sounds bad. But then I can say, well, 10 nanotesla, so that's 10 to the 8. So that's 10 to the minus 4. Gauss. All right, so that sounds bad. But then I can say that it's 2.8 megahertz per Gauss, right? And so then we say, oh, well, we have 300 hertz. And 300 sounds like a bigger number than, you know, 10 to the minus 4 or something. And so then we can say, oh, let me take this experiment. And let's modify it again. To run a Carpuccell sequence. So we have pi pulses here. And of course, I want to put pi pulses here. And that should be tau over 4, and t over 4, and t over 2, and t over 4. And we'll do this n times. And now the T2 over this whole thing will have a lifetime of about 100 milliseconds. So it becomes now the real T2. And then if I say, well, if I take T2 times this frequency, then that's a number like 30. And so we should be able to see that, right? So now then we say, oh, well, this isn't so bad, right? That I could effectively lock the motion of the spin I want to measure to the motion of my detector. And because I have them exactly in phase with each other, and I can make that exact because I control these pulses, then we can use this to suppress all of the background fields, suppress everything that might screw up the measurement, and make ourselves only sensitive to this local NV. Okay? If you do that, then you can see these small effects. And this experiment has been done. It's been done by Amir Jacoby's group at Harvard. And he's done it exactly in the scanning probe picture of looking. Now, he first fabricated not quite this, they fabricated a pillar and put the diamond, put a defect in it. So he knew exactly where to look. But even knowing exactly where to look, it's not an easy measurement to make. And he ends up getting the right piece. Yeah? Okay, so now that we say, oh yes, this is pretty good. Now I've got a system where I can say, ah, I have an NV over here that's far enough removed so that these two effectively don't see each other. In fact, you know, it would be nice if they were removed far enough that I had them outside of the focal spot of each other. And you can see if at 50 nanometers, the interaction is 10 nanotesla. At 2 microns, it's safe to say it's zero, right? So then we say, oh yes, if I have two NVs that are separated by some distance, then I can come over here with this detector, which is a little quantum system, and I can create a coherence here. And I can move it over here. And then I can do a gate. And it's the experiment that I want you to look at for your recitation is to say, let's do teleportation between the state of this NV. We're going to call this psi. I want to teleport psi to here. How many people know what teleportation is? Good. Enough that you can explain it to everyone in the class who doesn't know. So I'll leave that just for the recitation to have a look. Yeah?
The what? The recitation?
The tutorial.
Oh.
Sorry. Okay. Now, doing teleportation is a nice way to move a spin. But it's not a great way, let me say it differently. If I want to teleport a gate, then I should like to have some more resources. To have only one qubit moving back and forth is going to make an awkward way of teleporting a gate. And since we're sitting at IQC, or at least you guys are sitting, if you go to Dan Gottesman's website, then he tells you everything you ever needed to know about teleporting gates. So have a look. It's crystal clear. So now let's grab another degree of freedom. And we have diamond, and so diamond has, of course, lots of carbon. So we can take a C13 from the carbon. So if I look at my energy level diagram, let me blow it up a little bit. So again, that's the zero field splitting. And this is the Zeeman splitting. And I have my NV. And then over here, I'm going to take a C13, some adjacent piece. And there's an orbital here. If I look at the hyperfine interaction between the carbon and the NV, then at most it's about 115 megahertz, and it falls off. Now, the hyperfine interaction, as we've already seen, has two pieces. The Fermi contact that says the electron has to actually spend some time there, and the dipolar that says, no, they just need to be somewhere in space relative to each other. The Fermi contact turns out to be pretty small, so that you have to look really locally to find that. And so what you find is that the intensity of the hyperfine interaction falls off as 1 over r cubed. But if I asked how many spins are within a 10 megahertz window of the hyperfine interaction, then we have dozens of spins. Well, a dozen anyways. So it's easy to find. So what happens? So remember the hyperfine interaction. Let's just model it as Sz sigma z. Let's just keep that piece of it. Now remember that if I wrote out the full hyperfine interaction, we would have terms that look like this. And we would tell you, oh, we need to keep those because if two spins flip, then that's energy conserving. But now we're flipping one electron and one nuclear spin. And the electron spin is 1,000 times stronger than the nuclear spin. So these things vanish. And that's a nice story. So now I've got Sz sigma z. And I look at the system here. Well, in the Ms equals 0, Sz is 0. So we have two energy levels here. The minus 1/2 and plus 1/2 levels. They're slightly shifted from each other because the same magnetic field that causes the Zeeman interaction of the electron spin causes the Zeeman interaction of the nuclear spin. But remember that the nuclear spin is really, really small compared to this. And so this splitting is 1,000 times smaller than that one. Okay, so I'm quite drawn to scale. And then we have the hyperfine interactions. And the hyperfine interactions are going to give me a separation of levels in this plus 1 in minus 1 manifolds. So this is going to be minus 1/2, plus 1/2, plus 1/2, minus 1/2, and plus 1/2. That'll be the ordering of the magnetic quantum number for the carbon. And of course, the selection rules are you're allowed to flip one spin, right? That's dipole selection rules. So, you know, to flip one spin, we can do this transition, or I can do that transition. And you see that they become nicely separated by the hyperfine fields. And so to create a controlled NOT gate on these systems is actually quite doable in this. All right. So now let's look at a simple experiment. Let's take the electron to be in the zero state initially, and I'll put the nuclear spin to be in the minus 1/2 state. So we can prepare that initial state. And then I'll rotate the electron spin. So rotate about x the electron spin and create the state . So just some arbitrary superposition on the electron tensored with some state on the nuclear spin. Here, we apply a controlled NOT gate. So I'm going to flip the nuclear spin conditional on the electron spin. So now I'll have the state. Like so. And here, what I want to do is to make a measurement. So I'm going to measure the electron spin. So remember that we have one defect. So I have one electron spin. I make a measurement, what do I find? No magic here. I measure the electron. Yeah. Probability. Thanks. Good. So I get either 0, 0 or 1, 1 on that with probability alpha squared or beta squared, if you like. Okay. And conditioned on the measurement of the electron spin, what is the state of the nuclear spin?
So it's either one or the other in the distribution. Alpha is equal minus one or.
Oh, hold it. Okay. So it's one of those two, right? Good. Now I keep measuring. What's the state of the electron at the end of the measurement process?
Well, it's collapsed.
You've got to remember our physics here. Okay? So close Griffiths and say, with what's on the board, what's the state of the electron at the end of the measurement? So at the end of every measurement, the electron's always in the zero state, right? Because we turn on the laser to make a measurement, and we look at the cycling transition. So if the electron started out in the zero state, then of course it stays in the zero state. But if it started out in the one or minus one state, then eventually it'll have an inter-system crossing, and it'll end up in the zero state. Yeah. Well, you can count for however long you like, right? But if I count, and let's think about it this way. If I take the first photon, so I turn on my laser and I take the first photon, do I learn anything? Yeah, you don't learn. I mean, it's this word anything might be throwing people off, but you don't learn that if I, you know, regardless of which state you're in, you're going to get a photon. And so the fact that I get a photon doesn't tell me. The rate tells me something, but I don't know a rate from having one photon, right? And so you have to remember we drew a plot of the contrast versus measurement time. And you need to wait for a time that's of order this 300 nanoseconds to learn something about the state. Okay, so now here, I'm going to continue my diagram up here. So we had two things. We said that this was alpha star alpha, this was beta star beta. And here we end up in the state of the electron is zero and the nuclear spin is minus 1/2. And here, and let's just say that we have 0 and -1/2 and 0 and +1/2 here. Now I do a controlled NOT gate. So now I'm going to rotate the electron spin conditional on the state of the nuclear spin. And so now I end up back in a state that is 0 and -1/2 and 1 and +1/2. But I don't have any coherence in the system, right? All I have is now one or the other of those possibilities, right? So I don't know, perhaps, which one I have yet. But I have this or that. Yeah?
I'm confused. For the beta star beta channel,
yeah.
Should it be +1/2?
So when I make a measurement, thanks for the question. Let's go back here. Every time I make a measurement, I turn the laser on. And so now I'm introducing cycling transitions. And so if I started off here, I have this cycling transition that I'm introducing there. But 1/3 of the time, it's going to come here. And then it'll always go down to zero. So by making a measurement, we always end up resetting the electron to the zero state.
Oh, that's what you meant by keep measuring.
Yeah. Okay, so now that we have this, and now we can measure again. And of course, what do we see? We see that now, if I'm over here with probability 1, I find 0. If I'm over here with probability 1, I find 1. And of course, I still will not change the state of the nuclear spin. And so you can repeat this as many times as you like. We'll repeat it 100 times, and the signal-to-noise continues to increase. And so we can go through this as much as we like. Now, here's the trick question. If I want to know what this state is, I want to learn this. Or in fact, let me just say, if I want to know this, it's an even easier question. I just want to know that probability. What do I have to do? Is it enough to do this experiment? That's right. So if I do this once, so the nice thing about doing this experiment is that we get a detectable signal to noise for one defect in one of these manipulations, except we in fact don't learn alpha or beta by doing it once. If you want to recover those statistics, then you need to re-prepare the state and do this many times so that you're effectively making an expectation value measurement of that. Perfect. Okay, so now then, yes, in the lab, we create the state, we check, make sure it's the right state. But you know, if I have a quantum computer, I'll be given that. Don't make my lab stuff sound so simple, man. I was trying to convince you it was simple yesterday. But now you have to think about it as hard. Okay. So unfortunately, we've run out of time. But we can take these ideas, and now I can say, oh, no, I don't have one NV here. I have some small quantum processor. And then I can teleport to Gate. So then, I can connect these. Now there's one more way of connecting these that many people think about, is to say, imagine I put a spin chain, a one-dimensional spin system, on top of it. And then a one-dimensional spin system supports some nice properties of spin waves, and we can control things on paper this way as well. But no one's come close to realizing that. This has, in fact, been realized, and that's been realized. Okay, so if we think about DiVincenzo's requirements, what did we say? We said we have initialization. We said we had readout. Here we have universal control. We've got some control over the noise. And we're left with this question of, well, is it a scalable system? And this is not scalable, right? If I have a quantum processor and I have to move my gate between every quantum bit that I want to control, then absolutely we do not have something which we could call a quantum computer. And so this thing, one needs to ask, what's the next idea that leads to scalability? And if you have a great idea, then come to my lab and tell me and my students and join us and we'll try to do it. But we don't have the answer yet. Okay, so we're going to stop here. So thanks. Thank you.